Welcome to Extra Sequential. We are a weekly podcast coming from Perth in WA, which is Western Australia. My name is Chris.
My name's Mladen. We'll be talking to you about comics, graphic novels, manga, and other pop culture-y garbage. And this week, speaking of garbage, we'll be dissecting Kingdom Come.
Oh, you're ripe for a slapping, my friend.
Apparently. Apparently it's a very popular comic. I was not to know. But no, we'll be dissecting Kingdom Come later in the show. And also, Chris will be reviewing the premiere of Thor, the Mighty Avenger, or whatever he's called.
Yes, I don't think he...
Is he a Mighty Avenger?
He's, he could... No, he's just an Avenger.
A Avenger, just A Avenger.
A Avenger.
Oh, it hardly seems fair. Who decides who's the...
But he's the Mighty Thor, who's an Avenger. I don't know what his business card says.
The Mighty Four are
Four?
Four.
Maybe if they make four of them.
Oh, wow, that's...
Yeah. Thor 4, yeah. 3D.
Oh, you blew my mind just then. Well, that's what he'll be reviewing later in the show. And we'll also be doing what we've been reading and the news.
Mmm, chocolate mousse. Stan Sakai, he's the creator of Usagi Yojimbo, which has been around since 1984. He's their ninja rabbit-like creature.
Of course.
I don't think I've actually read any...
Neither have I. He's sort of in the same era and time of independent publishers such as Dave Sims, Cerebus, and people.
If you like Gru, I think, or Ninja Turtles, I think you say Yojimbo could fit in there. It's like a medieval wanderer.
He did cross over with Ninja Turtles, the Archie Ninja Turtles.
Yes. Yeah. So it's a black and white comic, been published from Dark Horse, and he's pretty much done every issue himself as a writer and artist. So he was named as the 2011 Cultural Ambassador by the Japanese American National Museum, which is the largest museum in America. Are dedicating to sharing the experience of Americans of Japanese ancestry. So obviously, yes, Stan Sakai is a Japanese-American or American-Japanese. So yes, he was honoured as a cultural ambassador. So good work. He's won quite a few Eisner Awards, which is kind of the comic book equivalent of the Oscars. So congratulations to Stan Sakai. Some good news for comics and recognition thereof. Now for something completely different, a man in a trench coat.
What? Oh, I see. I see what you did there. I'm terrible at this. DC have confirmed, and we've been sort of suspecting it for a little while, that John Constantine, the you might know... As played by Keanu Reeves,
yes,
in a film I'd rather not mention. Under the title Hellblazer, you may have seen. The Vertigo comic will now be returning to the DC universe.
Yes.
Now, to fill those in who be like, what?! Vertigo characters going to DC Universe?
Vertigo is its own DC Comics imprint that's been around since the late 80s. Swamp Thing and Fables and Preacher and all that.
Yeah, all sorts of Sandman and...
So they don't cross over with the superheroes and all that kind of
stuff.
Well, they used to, and now...
Yeah. That's it. Well, back in the 80s, when Swamp Thing was just under the DC banner, John Constantine was introduced in the pages of Swamp Thing. And they have been... Less so, Constantine, I don't think, has ever met any superheroes, but Swamp Thing regularly crosses over with Batman. Sandman, in the pages of Sandman, you can see he meets the Martian Manhunter, the Batman Superman pop up.
Yep.
And Death has very recently popped up in an issue of...
Action Comics. Swamp Thing, as I mentioned in the latest episode of Brightest Day, DC fortnightly series, the Swamp Thing returned as a big zombie... type creature. So it looks like John Constantine is also following the pages, and he'll be showing up, I believe, in the Flashpoint miniseries. So Flashpoint is basically DC's alternate universe kind of series that will be coming out soon, centered on the Flash, the guy that wears red tights and runs fast. So Flashpoint, so it looks like, John Constantine, if I'm reading this correctly, you'll be showing up in Flashpoint, Lois Lane and the Resistance. Interesting. I don't know what that means for Vertigo, but...
I suspect, and other people have been musing on the topic, that because Constantine is now kind of in his 40s and 50s...
Yeah, he does age in real time, doesn't he?
In the Vertigo comics, like he used to be in an 80s punk band, or 70s punk band, I should say. English punk was in the 70s, my bad. I probably got slapped just then by lots of internet listeners. But yeah, I'm guessing he'll be popping up maybe in a younger incarnation, maybe in the more recognisable bright yellow trench coat, dapper gloves, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it could be, because Flashpoint's an alternate universe thing, so he could be right there.
Yeah.
So we don't know if the proper mainstream John Constantine will turn up in the proper mainstream DC superhero series as yet, but it's possible.
Oh, anyway, that's something for me to prepare myself for.
How do you feel about this?
I'm not bummed by it in any sense, because I don't mind when characters like Swamp Thing and death and so forth mixed up with superheroes, because they always were. It was always suggested that they were part of the same universe in some sense.
Yep.
And Constantine, I think, is a strong enough character on his own to last that way. I think his whole thing in Vertigo Comics is that he rarely really uses any magic.
Yeah.
So I kind of suspect they'll make him a bit more of a Doctor Strange kind of character, and that he'll use magic more.
Yeah, he could be right there.
Because his thing is usually just being a smartass and saying
a bit of a con man. And, yeah.
Whereas in superhero comics, you have to back it up by punching something. So maybe he'll punch something. That'd be a first for...
I think John Constantine actually got mentioned in a Big Bang Theory episode I was watching the other day.
By Sheldon?
No, by the girl. Penny, is it? She went to the comic shop and said, oh, I need to get some comic for my 14-year-old boy. What do you recommend? And the guy said, oh, you know, he will love this. It's about a English detective guy, occultist. It was a joke.
Yeah,
English occultist who smokes a lot, has lung cancer, and has made a deal with the devil or something.
Mm.
She goes, everything a 14-year-old boy will love. So she bought Hellblazer.
Okay, moving on. Do we have anything else?
That's it. That's all I got.
Yeah,
quite weak. Our pockets are empty.
Which is good, because it leaves us more time for what we've been reading. All right, did you want to open up with what you've been reading this week, Chris?
Yes, I have read Super Dinosaur number one. So this is from Image Comics. I think in your stack there, Maladin, you have the Origin Special of Super Dinosaur, which is the Free Comic Book Day version, which will be out on May 7th, which is Free Comic Book Day. Yes, we have some sneak peeks of free comic books. Free Comic Book Day is on May 7th, by the way. So Super Dinosaur 1 has just been released this week from Image Comics. It's an all-ages book. It's written by Robert Kirkman, who writes The Walking Dead, now the TV series, and Invincible, and art is by Jason Howard, who worked with Kirkman on the Astounding Wolfman title, and also Sea Bear vs. Grizzly Shark, which we mentioned a while ago. But it's pretty awesome, actually. It's a first issue, first release under Kirkman's Skybound imprint, and it's actually sold out, this first issue, which is quite rare for all ages comics. Basically it follows Derek Dynamo, who is a young kid, and he's a bit of a science whiz, and he's like the star of the show. And the bad guy is called Max Maximus, who used to work with Derek's dad, Dr. Dynamo, and he created the Dino Men, and they've all got like cool names like Terra Dactyl, you know, T-E-R-R-O-R, and that kind of thing. Derek's dad discovers dinosaurs. Wow. In the hollow center of the earth, and then basically they fight over this mineral which they found, which is called Dinor. And as this issue goes on, they hire a full-time technician, which is a family, a father and his two girls, to help with Super Dinosaur suit. But Derek doesn't really want it because he's covering for his dad. His dad's getting forgetful because he got injured and he's losing memories and that kind of stuff. So it's not a hilarious book, but it's pretty fun. Super Dinosaur is basically this huge T-Rex that talks, and he's got little arms, but he uses his little arms to wear this harness, and he's got two joysticks, so he's got like big massive arms and stuff. It's kind of hard to describe, but there'll be pictures on our podcast. So the art's pretty cool. It's very cartoony with a slight kind of manga feel about it, and I really liked it. It's quite enjoyable. As I said, it's not hilarious, but it's very enjoyable, and I think it's one of those rare all ages books that are good for the young'uns. There's nothing here to for parents to be concerned about. There's no blood or nudity or anything, but it's also quite fun for the adults as well. And as I said, it's sold out. So if you do find one, Super Dinosaur number one, grab yourself a copy. Otherwise, grab the Origin Special, which will be out on Free Comic Book Day.
And if it entices people, I'm just flicking through, and there's a panel where he's slam dunking a basketball, NBA Jam style, the T-Rex, I should say. So if you want to see a T-Rex slam dunking a basketball, this comic could be for you.
Correct. I also read Dark Horse Presents. Now, this is a new comic, Dark Horse Presents. Dark Horse is one of the premier independent... Well, I suppose they're not really that independent anymore. They've been around for like almost 30 years. And this is one of their launch titles back in the day. So it went for a few years, and it had a lot of launched the work of a lot of creators like Frank Miller, Sin City, Paul Chadwick's Concrete, that kind of stuff. And then the print edition stopped for a while, and then from 2007 to 2010, Dark Horse Presents was on MySpace,
mm-hmm.
when MySpace was big.
What's MySpace?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Josh Whedon was on there and stuff. So when it was on MySpace, it was quite big, so that lasted for a few years. So this is a 80-page full colour.
Mm-hmm.
Introduction to a whole bunch, so it's an anthology basically. It's got Concrete by Paul Chadwick, and if I remember correctly, Concrete is a... I'd never read any Concrete, but I think he was a man that was abducted by aliens, and then his body was transformed into a big hulking concrete suit or something. Does that sound familiar, Mylan?
Never Euro heard concrete? Of him.
Okay. So that's the first story, and I think it's got the most pages of any of the stories in here. But Concrete is basically just walking the streets at night, and he stops this burglary, and then he finds this corpse in these people's car whose phone he uses to borrow. It's written with quite a poetic kind of emotional style, so it's not an action-packed comic, but it's more for the cerebral kind of thinkers like us. There's one, there's a whole bunch of stuff in here. Let's have a look. I'll flick to the contents page. It's probably the easiest one. Finder, Third World Chapter Number 1, is story and art is by Carla Speed McNeil. Now, I've been hearing a lot about this Finder series online, or reading a lot of about this Finder series online, but I haven't read any of it as yet. But there's a little sneak peek of it here, and it's basically about this guy going for a job interview. And then he's basically lying about his previous employment, and then he gets a job as a courier. But the other couriers, they have to deliver this package to the place next door, but like the elevators are broken and the queues are outside, so she doesn't even bother. So this guy just throws the package across the across the alleyway. But and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. And there's a cool one with Richard Corbin, horror writer and artist Richard Corbin, who did Hulk for a while. And it's basically this dystopian future, and a guy teams with a girl to retrieve his horse, and they kill some deadlings, which is their name for zombies. The best story in here is a Star Wars book, which follows bounty hunter Kirk Anos and his search for Mirith Sin, who's just been promoted as the head of Princess Leia's security, so it's set in the expanded universe.
Love those made-up-sounding Star Wars
names. I love the Star Wars names, aren't they awesome? So art is by Paul Galassi, which is pretty cool. His work is always... always nice to look at. It's odd because not all the stories in here are winners. There's a prose story by Harlan Ellison. There's a story by Frank Millan, an interview with him, and a prequel to Xerxes, which is the 300 prequel set about set in 499 BC, following King Xerxes. But just looking at the few pages that are in here, it doesn't look anywhere near as good as 300 or Sin City.
300 benefited a lot from Lynn Varley's colours, I think.
That's true. This is just black and white.
I like how a Frank Miller story is just four splash pages.
Yes, there's an interview with him. And there's some stuff from Mr. Monster is in here, which is an old, almost like 60s kind of homage comic. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff. I did want to mention that there is also... Howard Chaykin. Howard Chaykin's work is in here, which is kind of like a crime noir title. So that's Dark Horse Presents. It's got Concrete on the cover. I don't know if I'd recommend it to newbies, I think, because they're the first parts of ongoing series. These aren't done in one tales, so some of them are a bit odd. And like any anthology, it's not always a winning package. Neil Adams's one in here is just... outrageous. He's a great artist.
You've kind of lost interest in Neil Adams
lately.
Me
and many others, he's apparently, I just read online, he's getting back to X-Men, which he did in the 70s, so that would be good. And Brian Michael Bendis will be doing, or the Avengers, sorry, rather. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Neil Adams has been doing Batman Odyssey as both writer and artist, and it's just a madcap potpourri of ideas. And this one called Blood is basically about a guy getting tortured and spouting lots of exposition about this guy called Blood. But it makes no sense. I don't know. He needs to... He's a great artist, but that doesn't mean you're a great writer. Super Dinosaur number one and Dark Horse Presents number one. And yourself, Maladin.
I have been reading, this week I've been reading a few things and getting prepared for Kingdom Come Breakdown, because I really felt I needed to reread that. But in particular, I wanted to talk about, and this was a one-off story from a short-lived... small press, zine called Weasel. The story is called No Escape. It's by Patrick McEwen. And it differs, it's very different to normal comics in that it's really kind of the kind of spatial and like comics experiment which can't happen in other media. Yeah. I'll just break it down for you. So there's 10 comic pages, continuous sequence of four rows, three columns per page, so you can visualize it, and some panels join together to become two or three wide, but it's rigid, that sort of layout.
Yep.
And I read an online version which has all the pages side by side, which makes it much easier to read. But at first glance, it's this incomprehensible jumble of panels which don't actually read in the order, and there's no dialogue to help you. So if you start at the top left and go right, they're like, well, this makes no sense. What's happening?
Okay.
So at the beginning, you sort of struggle without any author's assistance to realign yourself with the new reading order. And then then you realize that the comic space matches the physical space. So it's like a cross-section through several buildings. So adjacent panels are adjacent rooms. So threads of the narrative are picked up along the page, like the secret agent bursts into the facility at the bottom left. He hits something, which is revealed later when you read the comic backwards. And then he disappears from his row because he ascends a staircase and he appears in the row above him.
Okay. Yeah,
so starting at the bottom tier, he moves up a tier. And you follow the characters rather than following the left down a row to the bottom left, like the typewriter format, you know, go to the end of the row, go to the... And then... Yeah, there's other stories that are picked up. So he drops this key, which a female janitor picks up, and she goes on her own story, which is separate to his and has its own timeline.
Wow.
And then there's the guards, which have their own, who are protecting the building, who have their own timeline. And he sort of goes through James Bond style until he's captured and tortured. Then the torturer descends into a brothel, so he goes down the tier again, and he starts moving left across the page, further complicating things. So he's moving completely counter to... how you normally read a comic, but it makes sense because you start following the characters. You go, okay, well, he's going through that door, so he's picked up there, and there he is. You know, he's moving along. And on the bottom right, there's this mysterious hulking male character who's in his own story intersects clearly with one that happens after the secret agent is killed. But as he keeps moving left across the page, he ends up right at the beginning of the story where the secret agent, and he's the one who gets hit by the car, but the secret agent was driving. So he's traveled back in time.
Okay.
Now, at first glance, you say that's a causality loop, but like when you think about it, it's like, well, he's moving through the panels at his own established flow of time, and it's perfectly reasonable given the physical space that, okay, time doesn't make sense in the normal way a comic works. So when you're reading this comic, your brain has to go, okay, I'm not reading a normal comic. This has its own rules, and very quickly you pick them up, and I was quite struck by how easy it was to realign yourself with a new way of reading comics that I had not seen before. So it's not a perfect comic. I mean, this drawing style is effective and consistent, but the story is kind of fluffy and a bit like pulpy, like it's just guys running through, and parts of it are still in the unfinished pencils rather than inked.
Okay.
So clearly he had to get it in before a time, like time date. But I really thought it's an example of what comics can do and what few comic writers actually do. And when Scott McCloud talks about his movement of time through a comic space, you know, how he breaks it down in his famous work, Understanding Comics.
Yep.
This is the kind of thing that demonstrates that. Yeah. But while the predominance of like comic creators think in terms of the fixed language, you know, of reading a comic, this is kind of, and thinking in cinematic or literary terms, this is McEwan, and I guess Art Spiegelman does similar stuff in his Breakdowns comic, and he just breaks the rules completely. So I thought it was just a really wonderful experiment, and it called to mind a lot of other comics which have done this sort of thing. I mean, Frank King, you know, Walton Skeezicks.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He used to experiment with physical space, the characters moving through like a single shot of like a beach, but then they appear at the bottom left again. You know, like when you reach the end of a row, you have to appear at the bottom left, and this sort of counters that whole problem. I think Will Eisner experimented with similar things with The Spirit as well, but I'm just mentioning these if anyone's interested in these kind of comics, because it's challenging to read at first, but once you get it, it just becomes like a new language, and it makes me kind of excited for what else you can do if you sort of free yourself from that kind of framework of how comics work. So yeah, that's one thing I read this week that got me really kind of excited about comics.
Awesome.
Yeah, sorry if that's a bit
No, that's good. I think, like you say, it's the kind of thing that only comics can do.
Mm. And it's out of print. And I just wanted to mention, if you Google No Escape and the word weasel, a gentleman's done like a critique on his blog, and they've kindly uploaded the whole comic, so you can read it on there. So, yeah.
Nice work.
Mm. And I mentioned to Chris before we started, but this week I've spent a lot of time nerding out, geeking out, watching Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I've never seen it before.
I've seen bits of it, but I haven't seen the whole, what, it ran from like 1987 to 90-something.
93, 94, something like that. And
make it so, number one.
That's exactly it. It's much more hard science fiction than I expected. Like, the special effects aren't always up to par with what they're aiming to achieve.
Yep.
But I like that really it's just them finding diplomatic ways out of complicated situations.
Yes, Jean-Luc Picard, played by Patrick
Stewart.
Stewart is more of a thinking man rather than Shatner, who's a rip my shirt off action man kind of leader.
Sleep with all the women. There is more of a Shatner-esque character in the show as well, I'm guessing, for fans who...
Is that Riker?
Riker,
the bearded guy?
Yeah, he's a bit more of the ladies' man
kind
of character. But generally, like, surprised me a lot. I think... if you've always been kind of like, oh, Star Trek, really? Then I think The Next Generation is a interesting place to start. Maybe have some surprises for you of what the show's act like, kind of more like. I just like the idea that they're in a future where all their physical needs are catered to. Like, they can just generate food. They can generate this stuff without any real effort. So then you're left with just improving yourself as a person. And that's their main thing. And I'm like, yeah, that's a...
Nice.
Series of ethics or whatever I could get behind.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway.
Plus they have the Borg, which are great villains.
Oh, I haven't seen them yet. I'm guessing there'll be a scary reveal.
First Contact, you would have seen the movie?
Yeah, I've seen the movie, so that spoils it. Now I know how it ends. Damn you, First Contact. Although I know Star Trek fans don't really like the Next Generation movies.
Really?
Yeah, like they're very...
The first couple were good.
Hmm. Like I heard they've changed Patrick Stewart into more of like just a bloodlust kind of creep. Like, who runs around murdering people without any real thought. Whereas this, like, killing one person, like, crushes him. And he's like, oh, my God, what have I done?
Yeah, I suppose they have to make everything bigger and action-y for movies, don't they?
Yes. For us, carpet waste, basement-dwelling mouth breathers who go to the movies.
See, I don't understand why mouth breather is an insult.
What's wrong with... breathing through.
It's just one more option. We had Easter at work, so we had some hot cross buns and stuff.
Oh, that's nice.
Lots of hot buns jokes going around. And then I hid some Easter eggs scattered around the office. And I
did our HNS think of that?
Emailed some cryptic clues, which are quite funny. So I said, if you don't think too hard about it, don't grind your teeth. So he'd run near the coffee grinder. Just plant yourself at reception, and then I put it behind the plant at reception.
Riddler?
I was quite happy. People were running to find them all.
Wow.
It was a good day in my life.
Riddle the this staff member. Those are good clues that you just read off. I like that. Maybe you should. We should do a prize for listeners of the show. Hide some Easter eggs around the city. So then in 5 years' time when they're scungy and... mouldy. Someone will find them when they're re-listening to the podcast.
Our listeners will be scungy and mouldy?
The eggs will.
Oh, right, okay.
Mm. Well, maybe we shouldn't do this. I've always wondered about, the hiding eggs around an outdoor area. Surely, like, in a month's time, like, a little kid will find them and then eat an egg that's been in the outdoors for a month.
Well, the trick is to know how many eggs there are.
Yeah.
And where you put them. And adult supervision is the key here.
Really?
Children cannot be left alone.
I've learnt that, yeah.
Why, you've got children?
No.
Oh.
Just by general observation.
Yes. You've watched Cosby Show or whatever?
Yeah, those kids always get up to shenanigans.
They do.
But a good talking to always settles things. Anyway.
And a hug.
Yeah, touching jazz music. Anyway, can we get on to your review of the Four?
Thor on the floor. Yes, let's do it.
I have sacrificed much to achieve peace. For through your arrogance and stupidity, you have opened these peaceful realms and innocent lives to the horror and devastation of war.
You are a vain, greedy, cruel boy.
You are an old man and a fool!
You're unworthy!
Father.
I now take from you your power! And I cast you out!
Alright, now, this week, Chris and I agreed we'd both watch Thor, and one of us fulfilled that end of the bargain.
You were filled with disappointments. Now I know how your parents must feel.
Oh. Yeah, old man, Chris.
Yes, Thor is the Marvel superhero. Don't put your microphone down, my legend.
What, you want me to heckle you while you're going?
You might be having lots of questions, which I can answer with great aplomb and authority.
That's possible. And a heads up before you begin, there might be... Chris will avoid from spoiling the ending, but there might be... He'll reveal plot points and things. We'll give you a heads up if he's going to say something that'll spoil the film for you.
There's not much to spoil.
Okay.
It's directed by Kenneth Branagh, who directed... who's mainly known for his Shakespearean films.
An excellent version of Hamlet, from what I recall.
Yeah, like 8 hour long or something. So his last film as director was Sleuth, starring Michael Caine and Jude Law, 2007.
And Tim Curry and Christopher Lloyd.
I think, no, that's based on the board game in the 80s, wasn't it? Cluedo? Was that what it's based on?
Yeah.
Why didn't they call it Cluedo?
It's just called Clue.
Oh, is it Clue?
The
okay.
film's called Clue.
But this one's called Sleuth, and it's based on a play, and it is awesome. It's basically, it's just got two actors in it, Michael Caine and Jude Law. You should watch them, Aladdin. I like films that are just kind of dialogue-driven, just a couple of people.
Yeah.
There's a great Hitchcock one, which is black and white, and it's called Rope. It's about these two college kids who murder, I think, one of their fellow students, to see if they can get away with it, and then they have a dinner party, and they leave his body in the casket in the lounge room, and it's awesome.
Are there slide whistles? This sounds like a recipe for comedy.
No, it's very serious. Deadly serious one.
Which was remade into Weekend at Bernie's at some point in the 80s.
So it's pretty funny, Thor. It's not bad at all. The first half in particular is pretty funny. Basically, Thor is played by Chris Hemsworth, who's an Aussie actor who was in Home and Away, and A Perfect Getaway with Mila Jovovich, which is a pretty good film as well. And he played Captain... who did he play? Star Trek's dad, Shatner.
Was that him?
Captain Kirk, Stad, father.
Oh, wow. I didn't make the connection.
He died in the opening scene.
That's right. That was crushing.
Yes. Yeah. So he played his dad. So Thor and Captain Kirk's father. That's pretty impressive from a pop culture standpoint. And he's huge in this film. He's like a bodybuilder. I expected him to be oiled up and posing in his jocks.
Yeah. He was always a tall dude, so he wears it well.
Yes.
Yeah.
So something in there for the ladies. And something for the men is Natalie Portman. She plays Jane Foster, who was in the original 60s comics, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Stan Lee's brother. Mm-hmm. I believe Larry Lieber created Thor in the 1960s. So Jane Foster, who was a nurse in the comics, plays an astrophysicist here. And she basically discovers, Thor basically gets cast out from Asgard, which is kind of his Lord of the Rings fantasy style place where all the gods sit. So his father is Odin, played by Anthony Hopkins very well. His brother, or we later discover half-brother, Loki, but you know, that's in the comics. And there's references to Bruce Banner, Hulk. There's references to Journey into Mystery, which I thought was pretty cool. If you see it in the town where he lands, it's like a small Midwestern town after he gets banished, and he's kind of walking around and doesn't understand all these human things. So, you know, goes to a diner and
throws... This is human emotion. I like love.
What is this coffee, this drink? I must have more. And throws the cup on the floor and that kind of stuff. There's a billboard saying Journey into Mystery, which is like a tourism billboard.
Okay.
Journey into Mystery is the Marvel series that he debuted in. Stan Lee has a great cameo. Hawkeye, this is surprising. Hawkeye is actually in there, played by Jeremy Renner, who was in The Hurt Locker. Directed by Catherine Bigelow, James Cameron's
ex-wife. He's moving on up in the world, isn't he?
So he's only in it for not even maybe 2 minutes. But Hawkeye is an archer in the comics, and he's one of the oldest Avengers members. He's got like a purple costume here. He's basically just all in a black get-up, and he is about to take down Thor. So it's an interesting cameo. We all expected him to be in there, but we expected Hawkeye to show up after the end credits.
Okay.
But here he shows up halfway through the film, which is pretty cool. And Donald Blake was the alter ego of Thor in the comics. So when... Because Odin wanted to teach Thor humility, so he made him inhabit the body of a mortal man until he learned his lesson, and then Donald Blake picked up this stick.
Kind of like Hercules in New York.
Exactly like that. Yeah. And smack it on the floor, and it'd be turned into Thor, so Donald Blake was his human identity, which he hasn't used in the comics for a long time. But here, there's an interesting reference to that character. So there's lots of little Marvel winks like that, which I was quite pleased to myself that I got. Mm. It's interesting because the film is set in, as I said, Asgard, and then it's set in Earth, and the Earthbound scenes are the best, or the romance between him and Natalie Portman isn't really soppy. It's not. It's kind of hinted at. It's more of a friendship, and kind of she's trying to understand his world. He's trying to understand hers.
Right.
But there's a really good character arc for Thor. Like he's about to become king, and then his enemies, the Frost Giants, invade Asgard. So he takes his buddies and wages war on their kingdom and unleashes hell. So Odin is like, I'm not happy with you, so cast him out until you learn your lesson. So he lands on Thor, lands on Earth powerless. So there's a good character arc for Thor, because he's kind of, most of the film, he's without powers. And then, but I do find, and again, this isn't a surprise for those of you who know the comics, Loki, played by Tom Hiddleston,
right,
British actor, he turns evil far too quickly after he discovers that he's actually, like, not his brother, but like his half-brother, or rather he was adopted by Odin.
Are you saying this is a surprise? That anyone was surprised that Loki turned out to turn evil?
Yeah, well, those who perhaps haven't read the comics, but it happens...
Don't know anything about Norse mythology.
But it happens very, very quickly. Yeah. Like, there's just... I don't believe he just turns on a dime like that. It becomes, what? You mean I'm adopted? That's it. I'm going to destroy Earth. I'm going to get you, Thor. I'm going to kill Odin. It just seems to come out of nowhere. There is a scene after the credits, but...
don't spoil that. People will
I won't, but there. I think only if you're a Marvel Comics fan, it'll make sense for the rest of you. I was disappointed. It didn't really mean much to me. But, yeah, it's interesting. So I think the Earth-based scenes are probably the best in the film. It wasn't hilarious. It wasn't... it was a nice mix. I must say I was slightly disappointed. I kind of can't put my finger on why. I guess Captain America comes out in July, so hopefully that'll be slightly better. But yeah, the Earthbound scenes are the best, and wherever it gets set back into Asgard to see the kind of political machinations and stuff, I'm like, let's get this bit over with. It's very loud in the Asgard battle scenes. It's just so loud. I saw it in 3D.
A lot of yelling or just loud?
Just loud sound effects. Like,
yeah.
And various things. So lots of magic and all that kind of stuff.
Hammering.
People shooting lasery stuff. But Thor flies in it, which is always good. I always like to see people with cape fly on the big screen.
Of course.
I saw it on a 3D, but it's not necessary. It's not a 3D film
at all. It's post-converted, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I only saw it on 3D because that was the earliest session. Mm. But seeing a 2D, you won't miss anything. The acting is superb. There is quite a few different... as I said, Jeremy Renner plays the Archer Hawkeye. Nick Fury does show up, Samuel L. Jackson. Anthony Hopkins was great. Rene Russo plays Thor's mom. And you've got Idris Elba, who plays Heimdall, who's like the guard of the bridge between our world and theirs.
From The Wire, Idris Elba?
Yes.
Yeah.
And a couple of little... But those characters don't really have a lot to do. Even Loki wasn't really in it for that much. It's mainly just Thor and Natalie Portman that are in it for... The main bit, and there's little bits where you think they could have gone too far, but they didn't. Like Kat Dennings, who plays one of Natalie Portman's friends, a group of three scientists. She like takes a photo of Thor with the shirt off and goes, "This is going on Facebook and stuff." And I thought,
"What is this Facebook you speak of?"
Well, he didn't. Yes, the book of the face. but yeah, thankfully they didn't have too many kind of modern pop culture references like that. They kept it to a minimum, which was nice. It's a good-looking film. Kenneth Branagh directed it really well. I know he's apparently received a lot of flack in England because he's, like, seen as a sellout. He wasn't meant to be, you know, the next Shakespearean great. And he's like, Thor's beneath Kenneth Branagh. What is he doing?
He did appear in the Harry Potter movies, didn't he?
That's true. Yeah. But so did a lot of other English great actors.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's great. I think if you're a Marvel fan, you have to see it, but it's not filled with references like... you might expect in the Iron Man films.
So I guess my question would be, there might be, I guess, two audiences for this film. The people who are like sort of generally kind of like, well, what is this Thor thing? I guess I'll check it out. And also the comic book Die Hard 2 will have like a range of knowledge of the Thor character. I guess what will each of those get out of, or who would like it more?
It sets up Thor really well. Like there's not too much exposition. Like there's a bit at the start with Anthony Hopkins' narration talking about the war with the frost giants and, you know, the Norse gods and all that kind of stuff. Humans don't believe in them anymore, that kind of thing. So it sets it up quite well, and it's never confusing. The story is quite easily to follow. So if you've never heard of Thor, this is an easy film to watch, and you'll get everything that you need from these characters in the film. But if you are a huge Marvel fan, there's not a whole bunch of action in it, but I think you'll be surprised. But as I said, as a comics fan, I was slightly disappointed. I guess I was kind of expecting more kind of comics references and stuff. I don't see how this will tie into the Avengers, I must say the ending surprised me. It doesn't set things up for a sequel. In fact, it seems to go things the other way. So I can only imagine that the Avengers will kind of tie up the loose ends that aren't tied up in this film.
So they'll have to Blues Brothers it and have to find him first and get him to join up kind of thing?
Something like that.
Yeah, okay.
J. Michael Straczynski, who's one of the... who brought back Thor in the Marvel comics.
Yep.
There's a lot of his... He was one of the eight screenwriters in this film. But he... yeah, he had a lot to do with. You could kind of tell Thor in Midwest America. A lot of that kind of stuff is from his comics. So that stuff, the Earthbound stuff, works well.
Right.
And I guess it's always the time, always the thing that happens with these first films is so much setup. So you'd imagine in the Thor 2, or even in the Avengers, the Thor won't be playing around in Asgard anymore. It'd all be set on Earth. And I'm curious to see how he kind of ties in with Iron Man and Captain America, because they're more science-based heroes in the Avengers. So it's interesting to see how, I mean, Tony Stark will just be, you know, drinking a whiskey and going, who's this Thor guy? Am I imagining him? You can't be a god. I will prove to you, me immortal. They don't speak Shakespearean, by the way. There's
really?
The acting and accents are done quite well.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's Thor. Yeah, you don't have to see it in 3D, but I enjoyed it, but not immensely so.
Okay, so very vague, almost recommendation.
I only saw it yesterday, so perhaps that hasn't settled in.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot of kind of,
yeah.
It was good, I think.
It was entertaining enough film, but I think because I want more from my superhero films, this was just like an action movie.
Yeah,
not a whole bunch of action. But
I wish Arnold Schwarzenegger was in this. I really do. Like if he was,
he could play Odin.
If he was 25 again playing Thor, I would see this film. If that could be arranged, I don't know how.
You could de-age him.
Lazarus Pitt, I don't know.
There is a de-aged Anthony Hopkins in here.
What? Really?
Yeah.
How does that look?
Just in the prequel. It looks pretty good in the earlier scenes of the film.
Hopefully better than de-aged Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, he does.
Oh, that's good.
Just a few wrinkle removals and it's done. And I think he has like a six-legged horse or something on here.
Oh, that sounds about right.
And he's got an eye patch. He looks pretty mean, Anthony Hopkins.
An eye patch, is that like a tie-in, product tie-in with
Nick Fury?
iPad and... anyway.
That's right. Thor.
Awesome.
It's now showing at your local cinema.
Bruce, I know you're down here. You can't hide from me.
I bow to your superior wisdom. After all, you know all about hiding. Don't you, Clark?
Don't call me Clark. What happened to the manor?
Once my identity got exposed, Bane and Two-Face happened to it. It doesn't matter. I have everything I need down here. Besides, it's not as if anyone intrudes on me. That hardly ever happens, Clark.
That's right. Someone told me your knights became free once genocide blew up Arkham Asylum and everyone in it.
Not to mention Belreeve Prison and Blackgate. Not an action I'd condone, but tell me the thought of it doesn't give your invulnerable skin a little tingle.
I don't have that dark side.
Tell that to your tailor. Black is a new look for you.
Alright, that was a scene from Kingdom Come, written by Mark Waid and illustrated by Alex Ross. This was published back in, what,
1996. It was a four-issue miniseries under the Elseworlds banner, which DC used to do and don't really do so much anymore. So it was the Elseworlds banner was like an alternate universe kind of thing.
Right.
Marvel's version is what if Wolverine died, or what if Spider-Man was a woman or whatever.
Of course.
This is an Elseworlds miniseries. It's set in the future. Superman has been retired for about 10 years. There was a Joker basically went on a rampage through the Daily Planet and killed everyone, including Lois Lane. So Superman basically just retires because all the heroes of his day are now getting...
Well, he retires because he's kind of the murderer of the Joker is acquitted in a court case, and Superman can't handle that, so he retires for some reason.
Well, you said.
Yeah.
So he basically goes off, grows his long hair long, gets a ponytail, and basically just goes into his farm in Kansas alone, secluded from the world. Mm. So while Superman's away, all these other heroes or anti-heroes have kind of risen up, and they don't really care about their fights if people get caught in the middle.
Yeah. Some might say Liefeld-esque heroes.
That is correct. Well, it's interesting because, as I said, this was published in 1996, when a time when the anti-heroes, your Venoms, your Punisher...
Your Cables, all those.
Yeah, everyone was getting black costumes and edged weapons and going bad. So all the good guys, were going bad. Green Lantern and
sure.
was going bad. There was a bad Superman and a bad this and a bad that. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of... It's interesting because it's kind of a love letter to the awesome DC Comics superheroes of the time and of the future, but also it was almost a condemnation, I guess, or a challenge of the comics that were very popular at that time, where, really, is this what you want? You want your heroes to be go around killing people, not caring about
right.
the sanctity of life? So Kingdom Come is a world where if the 90s comics continued and were real, this is the kind of world we'd end up in. So,
Because this is going to be more of a critique and we're going to be talking more about my issues with the overall comic, this has been kind of a bone of contention between me and Chris. Heads up, there might be some mild spoilers for the comic.
Oh, there'll be spoilers aplenty.
Yeah, so if you haven't read it and you'd like to, it's probably wise to maybe give it a read before you listen to this particular segment of the podcast, just so nothing's spoiled for you. Otherwise, there'll be interesting discussion, ahoy. But I guess we should maybe just mention the impact of this comic, because I know this comic in particular, I would say unjustly so, receives usually ends up in this kind of pantheon of, ooh, comics you must read, top 10 comics ever kind of thing.
It does, and I think Mark Waid is a great writer. He's done a lot of different stuff. He's written Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Superman. He's Justice League over the years. He's a very well-known writer. Mm. Alex Ross was just kind of starting his career. He did Marvels, which was in 1994, following The Journalist, which is his fully painted style, a painted style we don't really see in comics that often. But yeah, you're right. It's always on the top 10 list of comics, best comics of all time, and I'd certainly put it up there, but I do understand that it's certainly not a comic for newbies.
Yeah.
It's not something, if you don't read superheroes, stay away unless you like awesome art. When I picked this up, and I think us comic fans, superhero comic fans in particular, are very sentimental a lot. Mm-hmm. So I kind of...
Superstitious, cowardly lot.
So I was kind of getting into comics just a couple of years before this came out, and I just bowled me over because I hadn't seen Alex Ross's painterly style. It's all the biblical imagery, and it quotes Revelations quite a lot. The main character, Winsor McKay, who's... based on Alex Ross's dad, Norman McKay.
Yeah.
But his name is based on Winsor McKay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Little Nemo and Slumberland.
Yeah, Little Nemo and Slumberland.
Classic,
one of the
comics creators.
Yeah.
And the Spectre, who's this white ghost embodiment with a green hood and cloak, is the embodiment of God's justice. He's his guide, taking him through and visiting the various heroes. But yeah, it's one of those things again that only comics can get away with, and I was thinking about that as I was flicking through it again this morning. You couldn't find the equivalent of Kingdom Come in any other medium. It's jam-packed with references that only comics fans will get. It's almost like you have to have a degree in superhero comics before you read this thing. I mean, the main characters, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, people will know, and they're mainly, though, and Lex Luthor, are mainly through the characters that we follow and the characters that are centred on. So if you know those characters, should be okay, but there is a whole bunch of other stuff that won't make sense to you. I guess I don't know how much actually made sense to you. You're probably going, who's that guy? Why did he do that? Who's...
Well, I personally am pretty familiar with a lot of these characters in that, okay, I know who they are, but I guess it's a good place to start with because there are so many characters. The novel really has a hard time nailing down on who it really wants to follow. I mean, it begins with this framing device of this old priest and the Spectre, and they're really just used to introduce these kind of the themes and try to frame these superheroes in this much more grand style than they normally are. I mean, really, it is a very often used trope to kind of mix a story in with biblical end of the world myths and like Ragnarok and Greek myths. This kind of throws in a bit of everything,
but it does work well here, I think, because this is literally the story is about the end of the world.
Almost. It is. And I mean, just quickly, I mean, there's the Norse Ragnarok. Superman's kind of the Christ / Woden figure, Odin. Yep. Batman's almost like Hades in this. And it plays towards casting all the other gods. Green Lantern's kind of like this god character as well. But so many of them aren't developed in any sense. There's only really a small handful who are developed. And the rest, which get a couple of lines. But those other couple of lines are distracting enough from the whole thing where they could be adding to... someone else getting used in the story. That's kind of the thing I've noticed. I mean, it's not just this comic which does that. A lot of superhero comics have so many characters they need to use. This one has it harder because he's decided he wants to mention every single freaking DC character that's ever stepped foot into the comics. In that sense, I find it's very very difficult to... it seems like almost being confronted with, well, you don't know who these characters are. I guess if you don't need to know, why are they there?
Yeah, that's true. And I think both I've got the Absolute Edition, which we're looking at now, and there's actually a genealogy and stuff in the back. There's also a couple of extra scenes which weren't in the original comic.
Okay.
And there's a few different characters in here that are new, quite a few actually, like sons of you know, the original heroes. So here you can kind of see who each character is, and the sketches describing who you are. But yeah, Mark Waid and Alex Ross say they grew up with the DC, so they wanted to fit everything in. They put, you know, Batmite in there and just every character they could, even just in a little cameo in the background. I even recognised in some of the panels, like in the bar scenes and whatever, the in United Nations scenes, is like DC writers and artists of the day.
Yeah.
But this, it's interesting because this has had quite a impact on the current DC state, even though it's an Elseworld. There is a fair bit of stuff that is in this book that has carried over to the current DC comics as they are. So I think because it's such a definitive version, even though an alternate version of the future, it wasn't long after this came out that DC were kind of incorporating some of this stuff into their modern comics, into their current continuity. And forgive me, Miladin, but I'm just going to geek out a little bit.
Go for it.
Just give a couple of examples. We know that Superman from the future, he showed up. Superman from this is basically, he has more of a, you know, little dialogue thing that we did. You know, Batman said, black is a new colour for you because his S symbol is changed and it's got black on it. Mm-hmm. His colours are darker. So that Superman shows up in Superman Batman, the series. Wildcat's son shows up in the current Justice League. The Batman of many nations is first talked about here, which we now know is Batman Incorporated. Batman's son is in here as well, even though it's a different son in the current continuity. Rachel Gould's son.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, Rachel Gould's grandson.
Right.
And, yeah, there's an interesting Red Robin, who's the original Dick Grayson, who's now, you know, like a middle-aged man. He now calls himself Red Robin.
Sounds like a sex act, I've got to say.
Red Robin.
Yeah.
That costume is now that costume and name is now taken by Tim Drake, the third Robin.
Okay.
So there's lots of kind of stuff like that. The one year later scene is interesting because, kind of, spoiler alert, but Superman and Wonder Woman kind of get together, sort of, in the end, and they meet Batman at the planet Krypton, which is a superhero-themed cafe, and they ask Bruce to be the godfather of their child, which is pretty interesting.
I like the planet Krypton thing. I think
there's a great bit where they, from the waiter, they order a, the special is a Power Girl chicken sandwich. The cut is breast. It's Power Girl's for cleavage.
I got it.
it's a visual feast. It's very detailed. There's no blank stuff in here at all.
I mean, Alex Ross's art, I find... I may be one of few people who I don't really like his comic art. I like his pinups a lot.
Yeah.
I think he's still a very good artist.
Yeah.
I do think his art style is very static in that it slows your eye down too much. And this is probably a comment I have on a lot of painted comics, is that they do force you to slow down and look at the pages. Whereas, I mean, you know, like in a lot of other comics, you simplify the line work when you're in an action scene. In this one, everything is a tableau. Everything is like a wall-mounted painting. And it's it affects my reading of any scenes which is action, because then it starts to become incomprehensible when everything is fully coloured. The backgrounds are detailed, the foreground's detailed, the middle ground, and then the camera zooms around randomly. And there isn't too much actual... comicking involved. There's a few speed lines here and there, and Chris has turned to an appropriate page because the Flash is running past, and I like the way he drew it through the Flash, by the way.
That's Captain Marvel.
Oh, is it? Oh, there's another page with the Flash where
where it's like a constant blur.
Yeah.
I do know what you mean about the battle scenes. Like sometimes in the future, Superman and Wonder Woman build this huge gulag, which looks like the Hall of Doom, I think it was called, from the Super Friends TV series with the bad guys.
It is a callback intentional.
It is, yeah. There's heaps of references like that, and there's annotations in this edition, and there's interviews with Mark Waid and Alex Ross saying they wanted to fit in everything they possibly could. And some of the fight scenes between Superman's new Justice League and Lex Luthor's MLF, Mankind Liberation Front, and the bad guys are kind of awesome. But like I say, they are pretty crowded.
Well, as you and you mentioned, they wanted to throw in everything, and I guess we can just quickly return to, because we did mention kind of it is throwing in every character and everything they've ever done, and in a lot of cases it's just kind of like to satisfy people's curiosity, like, oh, what's happened to this character in the 50 years? And is they're old. They're the same but old.
Like Lobo's in here and he's...
And they say a familiar thing and they're fat. And it's and that's... They're like, for me, they're time-wasting cameos. It'd be like, if you did that in a film, it would be... you know, most of the writing time would be like nudge, nudge, wink, wink. If the Marvel films were all references to the other films they were going to release, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then that would be, for me, that this was kind of tiresome in those scenes. I want, just get back to the story. Get back to it.
Mm, but I like that. I like it because it's like a little knowing wink to the fans. Yeah. And this is made for a very specific group of people that grew up reading DC comics.
Yeah.
These aren't made for Marvel fans. This isn't a book made for people that don't like or read superhero comics often.
Why does it keep making those kind of like, oh, you should read this book 10 comics before you die and this one is on there? Is it because comic fans can't separate between a comic they like and a comic which is actually very good? Or do you genuinely feel like this is at a level...
I think you can... This is a book to read on the top 10 if you have read superhero comics for a while.
Okay.
That's the caveat there, that I think this isn't top 10 books for newbies.
Yeah.
But like you said, you know, I mean, most of the characters, and you have enough information to gather what's going on here. The story is not that complicated. And I must say, the dialogue is great. The pacing is great. It looks great, and I guess that's another reason why it's on, even though you disagree with me, because Alex Ross doesn't really do interior art anymore. He pretty much just does covers.
Yeah.
This was kind of one of the first books to come out in this fully painted style, one that we don't really see too much of these days, this photorealistic kind of painted style.
Mm-hmm.
I find Mark Waid knows this character so well. You know, there's a bit where, where Superman and Wonder Woman meet Batman, a planet Krypton, and Bruce, who's in almost like a full body cast over years and years of bloody battles over the years as Batman. He's got metal braces all holding his body together. But he kind of knows that Wonder Woman's pregnant because he sees a grey hair on her, so she's finally starting to age now that she's got a kid.
Sherlock Holmes, Batman.
And there's a bit where Wonder Woman gives Clark his old glasses as Clark Kent, which you never, just to kind of remind him of his humanity.
You're right.
There's little bits like that where I just found the characters were spot on, even just in a few, like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. Those are the three main characters, and their characterizations are just awesome. Like this, almost definitive characters, as say Dark Knight Returns or something like that would be, even though it's set in the future. This is a great embodiment of what these characters believe.
Well, I get what Mark Waid's really trying to do, and as you're saying in the characterization, it has to be spot on because really he's attempting to write the final story of these characters.
True.
Well, I mean, he leaves it open at the end because I'm sure he would have been happy enough to have it be the ending. I mean, really, if you have your Norse gods, they have Ragnarok and that ends all their stories.
Yep.
And with superheroes, it's kind of this never-ending thing. Usually, they never really age.
No.
If they don't age, and then it's like 1990, so you have to they were born in 1940, we have to do something here because people might catch on that they're 60 years old or whatever, you know.
Yep.
So, he's trying to write this ending story, and for me, he gets caught up so much in trying to give everyone their little moment in the sun. And there's only a few characters, which, as you said, their dialogue's fine. I don't really have any issue there. But I guess this is kind of my main problem with this kind of story. It's so overblown. I guess this is coming from me because I'm not really a superhero comics fan, and that's not a criticism of saying all superhero comics are garbage. That's me saying I don't like chocolate ice cream, but I understand why people like chocolate ice cream.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So don't take that the wrong way. And I'll admit that the book itself is fairly entertaining. You know, it's well put together.
Yep.
And I didn't say I hate the art or anything. It's just not the kind of thing I prefer for a comic. And it's an entertaining read. But then when I think about it, I'm like, that was unsatisfying because really it's the problem I have with a lot of superhero comics. The comics community has this tendency to overblow the sense of importance they place on these characters.
Yep.
And comparing Superman to Jesus Christ for me is that sort of example, or, you know, recasting everyone as gods. And in this case, it felt really shoehorned. A lot of the characters don't say anything because they've be put on this framing device of, oh, this is the end of the world and these are gods among men. But they're not, a lot of the time, they don't act like that in their normal comics. In this one in particular, they're acting more godlike than they ever have.
That's true.
Like a bit more arrogant than they normally do.
That's true. I mean, Batman is a bit more cruel and stuff, and Wonder Woman actually kills someone.
And
in
they
here.
Talk more like they're first time. Like we control this world. They act more like arrogant gods. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess that's kind of the the state of the world at this, and I guess they're kind of rising to it. It's a very dramatic book, is I think what you're saying.
Yeah, it's kind
almost
of
melodramatic.
For me, it's melodramatic. Yeah. And he uses like the apocalyptic and mythic shorthand as a way to give it this dramatic
gravitas
and dramatic weight that I don't think it necessarily earns.
It's appropriate
in the way it's presented, and I don't know if that's. That's probably more of a comment on this type of comic story than even this. This one's well written. I think it's what Kingdom Come to Me represents, and that's kind of superhero fans trying to cast. I mean, really, superhero comics are, when you get down to it, they are a commercial exercise. I mean, there is a lot of love and stuff thrown into them, but there is a point where you have to stand back and go, look, a lot of the decisions and characters are made, decided on what's profitable. For me, that's different to, say, Norse gods, which weren't really written to make money in any sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, they came around in a different sense. So when people try to talk about superheroes being the modern mythology, I don't agree with that. Maybe that's outside of this comic, because I've heard people talk about superheroes as modern mythology before. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that's true. It's a different definition of mythology. But, you know, we're no longer telling stories around the campfire. We just tell them on celluloid and on paper. But I think, you know, people in Japan know who Superman or Batman is, and people on the islands of...
But say, like, a Japanese person might read this and go, God, that's...
Depressing?
That's depressing, or complex, like, wow, they baffling. Think pretty highly of the... Yeah, it'd probably be baffling, like... The kind of self-reverence it's placed on it, like for an American reader or an Australian reader who's very entrenched in superhero characters, and for them these characters carry a lot of weight because it's something you've grown up with, and in a lot of cases, I mean, say a lot of people take moral lessons from these. So I guess that's the connection to the mythic.
Well, there's no other what else is there close to folklore? I mean, you know, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, for example, they've been around since before World War II. You know, three, four, five generations of people have grown up reading these heroes. There's nothing equivalent to that in storytelling today.
But the difference is, this is written by an... With the other, you know, myths, Norse, Greek, whatever, people... framed it. It wasn't like a particular corporate organization which said these are the official stories and these aren't. I mean, if you look at, you know, history of King Arthur, that's probably a good example because most of that's fictionalized.
Yep.
And most Lancelot's a fictionalized character which came about after several generations. Another writer wrote his own version and added in this other character so you could have a romantic subplot.
Okay.
It's driven by the people who've read it as well, whereas this is more driven by a particular group of people saying this is what's officially happening. I'm just saying the comparison is there's a difference between something which is by a single author and something which is by a mass of authors, which is kind of myths. I mean, really.
But this is, I mean, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, etc., as a whole, are written by a mass of authors, not just one person.
But someone decides which one officially happened, and these ones are out of continuity, and you don't need to read those.
But there's so many of each of these characters, there's something enough for everybody. And I think that Mark Waid and Alex Ross grew up with these characters, like we all did, and they're such fans that it's obvious their love of these characters in this series.
Yeah.
It is a very unique book in the history of DC Comics. It's kind of... When it came out, I remember it kind of came out of nowhere. And I remember even in Wizard magazine, there was like sketches and, oh, awesome, that's what Superman's going to look like in the future. And all that kind
of stuff. The same, but with the grey.
Batman's going to have like a big full-bodied, you know, armoured suit, and Wonder Woman's carrying a sword. And it's a very specific target audience.
Of course.
But I think if you're new to comics, you flick through it and you'll soon find out if you like it or not. The first couple of issues... It takes, you know, after issue 3 and 4, that's when the big battles begin, and that's when things get quite dramatic and serious. But the first couple of issues are more introducing the characters.
Do you agree with me that the Shazam characters kind of shoehorned into it a little bit in the last couple of acts?
They talk about that later because Mark Waid, Captain Marvel, he's the guy they call him the Big Red G's. He's the guy with the lightning bolt and the cape and Billy Batson. So he says Shazam, lightning bolt. He transforms into Captain Marvel. He was a Fawcett character, not a DC Comics character. He was published by Fawcett Comics back in the 40s, and then DC brought that character.
Mm-hmm.
So he's never been one of the true DC Comics characters in that sense. And they do talk about that, like they were a bit umming and ahhing if they should bring Captain Marvel into it, but really he's the only equivalent of Superman.
Right.
He's the only power equivalent. So Superman and Captain Marvel have a pretty brief but powerful fight in here, because one of Superman's weaknesses is magic, mm-hmm. which is Captain Marvel's whole thing. But yeah, they do kind of a little bit shoehorn him in, but he's the only Superman equivalent that could kind of match him blow for blow.
Yeah,
there's no other character that could do the same thing, and a lot of people die in here.
Yeah, I mean,
but there's hope at the end.
Well, it's kind of because for me, like, because so few of them have any point in the story, they're just kind of little background characters, and they die and like, boo hoo. Like,
don't care when they die. Yeah.
All the main characters survive, so yeah. You know, yeah. But like, there was a particular quote in here which I liked, and it's from issue 2, page 12. It's the third and fourth panels, and it's just the Spectre talking to Norman McKay.
Okay. I
can't believe I remember his name. And he's saying, "What do you see? What do you hear?" And then the Norman McKay character says, "A jumble of images, a cacophony of apocalyptic verse." And that's... He probably doesn't say it in that sense, but yes. For me, that describes how I feel about the whole comic. It's like this whole jumble of things, which to me, they don't go far enough in making work together. From, I think for people who've always suspected, oh, superheroes are important, this works for them.
Yes.
For people like me who don't feel they're particularly important, or that maybe they really don't have any relevance anymore.
Yep. This is a bit of a chest beating exercise.
Yeah.
You see it as.
Yeah.
I think the 4 issues isn't long enough, and they
talk about.
There was a couple of miniseries and one shots after this was published called The Kingdom that focused on the same universe but set on the younger generation of heroes. But yeah, it needed to be almost like a maxi series, like a 12-issue thing. But unfortunately, Alex Ross is. Once you see the art, you realise why he's not the fastest artist, understandably.
Yeah, of course.
So 4 issues is pretty much the best they could do. But I agree what you say in that it could have... The minor characters could have had more of a story arc and a character arc and more lines to say, but there's just not the room in these 4 issues.
No.
It's only, 120 pages or something. So,
yeah. I think we see each other's points on this one, and I'm happy to agree to disagree because I get where you're coming from, and I think we different backgrounds give you a different reading of this comic. But I disagree with you that it's really something that new comic readers need to read for a long while.
Yeah.
But I have lots of little nitpicks.
Oh boy!
And I'm sure you can answer some of these, but like. Superman's a really terrible person in this.
He's pretty selfish, and I think, as soon as Lois Lane dies, so I think they were married.
As soon as Lois dies, and one court decision doesn't go the way he wants, because he doesn't want Magog to get away with murdering the Joker, right?
Yeah.
He decides, well, that's it.
No, he doesn't want Magog kills
Joker. Like, as justice or whatever for killing Lois Lane and these other people. And Superman goes, well, I'm going off to my farm for 20 years and not going to help anyone.
10 years, but yes, you're right.
Oh, whatever. Yeah, sorry. But yeah, that to me, like, what kind of alien Superman does that?
I think it was a combination of stuff, not just that, but also that by that point already, and the series does talk about it, like the public opinion had turned against him, like he was still seen as a big blue boy scout. And Magog, who's this big golden staff, helmeted, horn-wearing guy, he basically shoots people. So he's... he was more popular because he was killing the bad guys, whereas Superman was, no, we can't kill, we're the good guys. But the public's like, ah, Superman, we need to kill people, we need to teach these people a lesson. Superman's like, but I don't believe in that. So I guess he just had enough.
He's more like Jean-Luc Picard and doesn't agree with killing everyone.
Correct.
But where do they get off, I mean, really blaming Magog for attacking that parasite guy? Like, that's what triggers this big explosion in Kansas, which kills a bunch of people.
The parasite's an old Superman villain, and, Captain Atom, who's basically a nuclear thing in a suit, and Parasite kind of cuts him, which they're effectively destroys Kansas and killing a
million
people.
Captain Atom never thought could be a possibility in his line of work. But, like, how is that different to what the League of Heroes then do in the next couple of pages, which is going around beating up all the other superheroes and bullying them and taking them down with superior numbers? The exact same thing.
Well, they don't kill them, but they put them in the prison to kind of re-educate them and re-teach
them. Yeah, but they still attack them and beat them down and all this stuff.
That's true, but that's the only way to get them in prison.
So why does Magog get blamed for this thing, which was an accident, and they were doing the same thing in the next page anyway? Is it because his went wrong and theirs didn't?
Well, Magog was going to kill Parasite, but Superman's intentions were never to kill the anti-heroes, rather just to capture them and re-educate them.
Mm. Well, I still think the apocalypse is entirely all their fault. the good guys in this one. They bring it on themselves by trying to go, well, you have to stay in our special prison. And
it's interesting because, Batman's also got a bit of a police state in the future of Gotham. He's just stuck in his Batcave.
Judge Dredd, yeah.
Yeah, and he's got all these bat-armoured, mechanised soldiers running around patrolling the streets,
yeah.
Which is pretty cool because he can't find himself anymore as he's an old grey-haired man.
I'd have to check again, but I feel like there's a couple of scenes where Batman's robots are taking down muggers, and I'm pretty sure in all those scenes the muggers are black. Now, I don't know what that says about Alex Ross and Mark Waid. Now, Chris is checking this for me.
Could be right there. Next nitpick.
Next. and this is not... Okay, the Wonder Woman thing. Now, how do you feel about... Like, I've always felt Wonder Woman as a trinity of, like, DC superheroes, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Always feels shoehorned to me. I don't think she gets that kind of respect in terms of the comics she's made, been starring. It's really just because she's the only woman that anyone remembers.
And she's been around for the equivalent amount of time as Superman.
Yeah.
Batman.
So I guess, is that the only reason? Because of the time? Or?
In one panel, there's some black people.
Are they mixed race? Okay, they're black people that... Is Batman just go around chasing black people?
Well,
I always suspected, Chris.
In that one panel, yes. But there's other panels later.
And at the end of this comic, I think he becomes the White Knight. Am I correct?
He does wear a white shirt, yes. Rather than a black shirt.
Okay. No, maybe I'm reading too much into that.
I think Wonder Woman's an interesting character because in here, this is the first comic she actually kills someone. She stabs some German guy through the chest with his sword.
We should clarify, he's a supervillain.
Yeah.
Just some German guy.
Not a tourist.
Yeah.
No. Put down your wiener.
But okay, as a general thing, do you think she's earned that place? I mean, for me,
not in the amount of awesome comics she's had, that is correct, but I think her character is pretty interesting because she's an ambassador for peace, but she kind of carries a sword, and that hasn't been as well clarified in this comic as it has in any other. We really get to the core of Wonder Woman's character. Like, she knows she's actually been kicked out of her Amazon sisterhood out of Paradise Island, so she no longer carries the title princess in this comic because sisters believe that she hasn't been a great ambassador.
She hasn't succeeded.
So here she kind of toughened things up and she really wants war. Superman doesn't.
I've just realised with you flicking through that there's a fair few scenes where he could be any race. No, he's shot from behind. I'm just with the race thing.
See, black people are being held up. A white man and a black man are hugging.
Oh, that's nice.
At gunpoint.
Okay, I guess Mark Waid is for interracial homosexual relationships. So I guess he's not a racist or whatever. In Gotham, that's fine, because it's a police state. Okay, but there's a team of Japanese superheroes. Now, are they invented for this? And the team of German superheroes?
Yes.
Or are they like Mark Waid's best imagination of what Japanese superheroes would be is a dude who's dressed like a samurai, a dude who's like, like a sumo wrestler? They're all kind of the most obvious things he could think of.
I guess they had to be obvious because he wanted them... Because like you say, most of them would just show up in the background or a panel or
in
two.
In one panel, yeah.
This is interesting in the sketches. This is the Beatles, Sergeant Pepper's made as Japanized mechanized robots, which I don't think actually ever showed up in the comics. Then there's German heroes and American heroes.
I guess, you're right. He's using shorthand and then he turn up in a few panels. But like the German superheroes all have like the black
Von
cross.
Buck. Yes, the Von Buck. Cross.
They have like the... I forget the name of that cross. You always see it
on... The Iron Cross?
The Iron Cross, yeah. And that's the symbol he could think of for Germany. It's just like... It's very obvious. I don't know if that's just laziness on his part or...
I guess you just wanted to show kind of the international...
These are Germans. Superheroes. They all wear iron crosses. Yeah, anyway.
Next. Let's keep it moving.
Keep it moving. All right. All I wanted to say was I'm very satisfied by the ending where everyone gets incinerated.
But most of them. Some baddies survive and some goodies survive. Thankfully, all the main heroes that we mentioned survive.
Yeah, I found I hated their Mightier Than Thou thing through the whole comic so much that I was so pleased by the time they all got incinerated. And none of them were really fighting for anything worthwhile. They were just being bullies.
Well, I guess the main thing was they were just defending helpless citizens that were caught in the crossfire of this future war between superpowered beings.
By starting an apocalypse, they thought that would be the best way to defend...
Well, they didn't set out to start an apocalypse, but, things escalate when superheroes battle. But, so that's Kingdom Come, Mark Waid, Alex Ross, DC Comics. There's a there's the absolute edition is out now. You can get a softcover trade paperback, and I think there's even a more fancier edition than the one I have, just coming out next year.
Oh, cheated you out of your hard-earned
money. Can't imagine
Chris.
What else would be in that. Maybe a lock of Alex Ross's.
The story
hair.
Is in there twice, so it's double the thickness.
Oh dear. It's one of the things that only comics can get away with, but I love it. But as I said, superhero fans are a very sentimental bunch, and it's told a place dear to my heart. But, yeah, so that's Kingdom Come. Next week, we don't know what we're talking about.
I think it's, next week, yes.
Let's send talk in about your questions.
Sex, baby. Yeah, we'll try to do our best.
I have no idea, but glad it'll be happy to help you, I'm sure.
Hey, what does that mean? Am I like David Hasselhoff here? Not really. Next week, I think we'll be talking about the Free Comic Book Day. Just give you a preview of what's coming out.
Yes.
And I won't announce the topic because we announced it last week and didn't do that topic.
Correct.
So
we will talk about body image and that kind of stuff at some future point. But yes, FCBD, Free Comic Book Day, next week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not next week, but May 7th. But we'll be telling you which ones to buy and you'll be obeying us.
Yeah, apparently. You've been listening to Extra Sequential Comic Book Podcast. That was Chris. I'm Aladdin.
Yes.
Check out more shows at www.extrasequential.com or on iTunes.
Correct.
We have a Facebook page, and we would really like people to friend us on there and tell us what suggestions you'd like for future shows.
Yeah.
Just tease us in general. That's fine. Chris, you can email for giving feedback and other abuse at chris@comicbookjesus.com or chris@extrasequential.com.
Correct, Amando, sir.
Music for the show is purgeaudit.com, and that wraps us up.
Oh, well, let's put a bow in it. Enjoy your long weekend.
See ya.
Bye.